Welcome, children, to the Adventures in Finance Bedtime Story Hour. We have a very special treat for you tonight. Our reader for the evening is President Donald Trump.
Tonight, we are reminded of our nation's path, and a new surge of optimism is placing impossible dreams firmly within our grasp. My economic team is developing historic tax reform that will reduce the tax rate on our companies. At the same time, we will provide massive tax relief for the middle class. We must create a level playing field for American companies and our workers. This effort will be guided by two core principles: Buy American and Hire American. I will be asking Congress to approve legislation that produces a $1 trillion investment in infrastructure of the United States, financed through both public and private capital, creating millions of new jobs. I am asking all citizens to join me in dreaming big for our country.
Sleep tight, everyone, and sweet dreams.
But sometimes when we go to sleep, instead of dreams, we have nightmares.
We need to see the policy before we know. We have to understand if that's going to get through Congress.
I think we just have to be realistic that this is likely to be a sluggish growth environment still.
A recession's overdue. The average recession comes between 7 and 9 years.
He can't repeal the economic cycle. We're very, very late.
Key thing to remember for everybody is it won't happen in a day or a week or a month.
If he wants to get this done, if he's politically motivated and he wants to get this done, a recession is a good thing.
But the point is that there can be some real negative.
So much bickering that all the promise and hope and dreams now comes down to the reality of the political system. Dreams end up getting trimmed and trimmed and trimmed down to something that's barely possible.
This week on Adventures in Finance, we deconstruct the dream that is the Trump reflation trade and explore why we think this narrative is about to enter the political house of horrors. David Hay of Evergreen Gavkal, Dr. Harold Malmgren, economic advisor to four U.S. presidents, and Raoul Powell, author of Global Macro Investor and co-founder of Real Vision, guide us through Trump reflation and how narrative-driven markets could be the most dangerous beast of all.
Also in this week's episode, we have our regular long and short feature in which Aaron and I discuss the good and the not-so-good stories of the week.
I am long data set innovation. Trump was actually targeting specific communities, specific nodes in the social media network with micro-targeted messages.
I'm actually short hedge fund fees this week. And it was a story about some Asian hedge fund startups who are getting away from the traditional 2 and 20. And they're starting to charge investors no management fees.
Finally, in a segment we call Things I Got Wrong, we speak with a market expert about something they got wrong and get them to share a pearl of investing wisdom with the benefit of 2020 hindsight.
Yeah, this week, one of the most humble investors you're ever likely to meet. He really is a dear friend of mine and a fantastic investor, David Hay, the CIO and partner of Evergreen Gavkal in Seattle.
I guess the best advice I'd give to a long-term investor is to have a core position, but be willing to trade around that, you know, under those parameters. And we've been doing that more and more, but certainly in the past, I feel like that's been one of my bigger mistakes.
I'm Grant Williams.
I'm Aaron Chen, and this is Adventures in Finance. Today is March 30th, 2017, and welcome to episode 9 of Adventures in Finance. And to my right is my trusty producer, James. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Why do you say trustworthy?
Well, I say trusty because, well, I've been off the last couple of days. My parents and my family came to visit, and I've been playing tour guide and also playing tourist on the island, and I came back on Tuesday and everything was intact. So
yeah, basically,
pretty trustworthy by my book.
The boss has let you out of the office to explore the wider world of the Cayman Islands then.
Well, it was great. And not to, you know, this isn't a Cayman Islands tourism board PSA or advert, but there's actually a lot of fun things to do on the island, and it was fun to be a tourist for a little bit. And before going to the university, I did a lot of traveling for tennis, and I never felt like I got to play the tourist. So it was kind of fun. But you know, I actually would love to ask Grant, because he does a lot of traveling, whether he ever feels like a tourist wherever he goes. So Grant, where in the world are you?
Well, I am. I'm back in Singapore this week. Had I known that you were going to leave the keys to the kingdom with James, I would have put a stop to that immediately. Thank God you've come back and the whole thing has been burned to the ground. But yes, I'm back in Singapore. But I will be headed your way shortly, guys. So the next time we speak, I will be back on that side of the world.
Something tells me, Grant, that I'm still going to ask you where you are just through force of habit.
Yeah, but yeah, and I'll be sitting next to you. I can just flick your ear then. That's going to be easy.
Well, no, something tells me that Grant's probably not going to come directly here. He's probably got about 20 stops between Singapore and when he finally gets back to the Cayman Islands.
You know what? I may have to change my opinion about you, James. You are absolutely right.
Oh, great.
That shows remarkable insight from you.
Thank you. No, it's just, you know, I'm learning.
All right, well, let's move on to our first segment, Long Short, where Grant and I go through the long, well, the good and not so good stories of the week. Grant, I went first last week, so I think it's your turn.
All right. Well, this is, I got a great one this week. I am long Ukrainian hackers and their software adjustments for American farmers' tractors. Now, this is an astounding story. John Deere have put locks on the tractors. You know, we're talking big farm equipment here that they sell right across the heartland of America. And if you want anything done, any servicing done, you have to call your local John Deere representative to come out and fix it for you. And obviously, by definition, a lot of these farms are out in the middle of nowhere. And so America's farmers have found that on certain parts of the internet, you can subscribe to dummy websites where you can get Ukrainian-hacked firmware patches for your John Deere tractor, which allows you to hack into it and perform what are designated as unauthorized repairs on the farm equipment. Now, amazingly, when you buy these tractors, you have to sign a piece of paper with John Deere, which indemnifies the tractor manufacturer against, and I quote, crop loss, lost profits, loss of goodwill, loss of use of equipment arising from the performance or non-performance of any aspect of the software. I mean, it's absolutely astonishing that that through this software you can control how a farmer uses this tractor, and the farmers are afraid that John Deere can actually shut the tractors off remotely should they find anything remotely going wrong. So I through the software and shut these things down. So, hey, listen, you and I, this is way above our pay grade. But for once, I am long Ukrainian hackers who are helping America's heartland farmers pull their crops in without any interference from John Deere.
Well, that can't be good for John Deere's earnings because, actually, Grant, it reminds me a little bit of the planned obsolescence that goes into Samsung phones. Now, I'm not accusing of John Deere doing the same thing, but probably doesn't help the turnover of John Deere's inventory.
Well, yeah, but I think Samsung has taken the planned obsolescence a little bit too far in making them self-combust.
Yeah. All right, well, Grant, that's a really interesting story. My long for the week, it's definitely on the nerdier side, but I am long data set innovation. And I read a really interesting article. It was actually a blog post written by this guy called Curtis Miller at NT Guardian. And it's about understanding data from a hierarchical perspective, meaning, you know, there's data that's commonly available, there's data that's private, and then there is unexploited sort of greenfield data. And he explores this theme in terms of how the Trump campaign utilized data in order to craft sort of micro-target its messages according to psychographic profiles of voters in key swing states. Now, it contrasts this with what the Obama campaign did in 2012 and the micro-targeting that they did, but theirs was sort of blunter in the sense that they just, you know, they were switching out celebrities with, you know, similar messages, but Trump was actually targeting specific communities, specific nodes in the social media network with micro-targeted messages. So I just thought that was, you know, it's an interesting way of thinking about data because, you know, a couple of weeks back we had a fascinating interview or we revisited an interview with James Crawford talking about the use of satellite imagery data in order to figure out trends in oil and trends in retail. And I just thought, you know, it helps kind of frame our thinking in terms of structured and unstructured data and what's possible. So Grant, this week I'm long data set innovation.
Well, and I am absolutely certain that the three people still listening are fascinated by that, Aaron.
I almost pushed stop on that one.
You should be.
I have to say that the Trump data stuff is actually, it's fascinating. I've read some really interesting articles on that. So I hear you on that. I just didn't understand a word of what you just said. That's all. Luckily, I've read it, and there were some nice pictures in the article I read. So, well, on the short side, I'm actually short hedge fund fees this week. I saw an interesting story actually that featured, once I got halfway through, a dear friend of mine, and it was a story about some Asian hedge fund startups who are getting away from the traditional 2 and 20, and they're starting to charge investors no management fees, and actually taking performance fees and absorbing some of the losses. And a great friend of mine of many years, a guy called Mike Downer, who is working with another good friend of mine, Steve Diggle, and neither of them know I'm talking about this, and this is definitely not a plug, but they started something called Kit Trading, which basically is a group that identifies and seeds a bunch of different strategies, and investors can invest in these. And there's a few of these around Asia. This is not just exclusive to Kit. But these guys are seeing a lot of people pull back after some of the high fees and underperformance in the hedge fund industry. And so what these guys do, they absorb first loss. So it's going to change the entire industry, I think. There are a lot of hedge fund traders that have good track records and are looking to kind of get out and maybe go out on their own and get out of the constraints put on them inside big funds. And so a lot of these guys are setting up shop, being seeded by groups like Kit, and putting their own money in. So they themselves lose the first part of any loss they make. And I think it's going to be very interesting to watch this develop, with funds charging like a 1% fee and then spreading the profits with their traders. They build a great portfolio of different strategies. So it's going to be very interesting to watch this take, and it's going to put, I think, a lot of pressure on the traditional 2 and 20 model. So I am short exorbitant hedge fund fees this week.
Well, to the two listeners who are still listening to the to the podcast after that.
Hey, listen, I only lost one.
Well, Grant, hopefully it does change the industry for the better. But let's move on to my short. This week, I am short billionaire bunkers, which is the fastest growing part of this disaster preparation sector. This was a story I read out of Zero Hedge, and it was an article on disaster shelters for the ultra wealthy. Now, I'm calling them shelters, but I think it's kind of disingenuous, because these things are decked out with all the luxury fixings you can think of. You know, swimming pools, cinemas, fitness centers with all the latest weights, and wine cellars. And apparently there was a surge of demand from both sides of the political spectrum leading up to and following the US presidential election. Now, as great as all this might sound, I'm short these types of setups because, you know, instead of bunkering yourself in a place that isolates you from the rest of the world, you know, the outside world, you know, meanwhile surrounding yourself with people who you don't know and, you know, you're not sure whether they have the same values, why not take the time and effort to actually build solid relationships and preparations with like-minded, self-sufficient people you can trust in times of ultimate crisis? So look, to each his or own, but maybe it's just not how I would go about prepping, I would go about prepping differently. So this week I am short billionaire bunkers.
Well, you know, I'm listening to you, and all I can think of is just imagine, James, you and I paying our money to get the safety of being in a bunker and being stuck in one next to Aaron talking about some of the stuff that he talks about. I mean, can you imagine? I mean,
how thick are the doors on that?
You'd be using the lid of your canned food to slash your wrists.
No, I'll have all the peanut butter and honey, so I think you're going to want to make good with me.
All righty. Well, it's time to move on to our next section, which is our documentary feature.
Please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute.
The office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability.
And will, to the best of my ability.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
The Constitution of the United States.
The Constitution of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations.
Well, this week for our documentary feature, we are going to be talking about the reflation trade, or the reflation narrative. Grant, if we take this back to, you know, before the election, the U.S. election, the American people were presented with an establishment candidate and a populist candidate. And right before the election, the market narrative was that Trump is negative for markets, and Clinton was positive for markets. Would you say so?
I would say so. And I think it's interesting what you said there, Aaron, when you said the reflation trade or the reflation narrative, because that's what's essentially happening. A trade has been formed from a narrative. And as we know, narratives tend to change or be proven wrong. And I think that may be where we are. So,
and yeah, and even before the final results were in, you could see it in the market's reactions to the presidential debates 1, 2, and 3. You could see it in the way that the dollar peso moved relative to Trump's comments on Mexico. You know, the ping-ponging between the FBI's investigations open and closing, opinion polls. So going into it, the mainstream media predicted a Clinton landslide. But Grant, as we know, the media and markets were in for a rude awakening.
So I was in Texas that night with a few other market commentators, and I was interested that the general consensus was, as you alluded to, that Clinton was going to win and Trump didn't have a chance. And I didn't think that. I actually thought Trump was a shoo-in, as I've been writing for a while before. And I think the initial reaction was very, very interesting to see. I mean, the Dow Jones, the SPY futures just plummeted. The Dow was down 1,000 points in a matter of minutes as it became clear that Trump hadn't won. He had a really good chance of winning. But within hours, the futures did a V-shaped bottom. They were down 5%. They went up 6.5%. And everybody everywhere was just scrambling, looking for some kind of narrative to come out of this. And the market has been in a real bull trend for a long time, and so it was clear it was looking for a positive narrative, and the one it seemed to have settled upon was the Trump reflation trade.
And it kind of makes sense, right? Because you look at some of the things he was talking about, tax reform, be it at the corporate or individual level, and you look at infrastructure spending and economic nationalism or isolationism, it kind of makes sense. You know, copper was up over 25%. Oil was up 28% until the recent sell-off. So looking at these things, it kind of begs the question, you know, are the good times back?
And we will make America great again. God bless you and good night. I love you.
Judging by equities and the indices that stand to benefit the most from the potential Trump policies, it would appear so. Up until recently, the U.S. financial and aerospace and defense indices were up over 15%. The heavy construction index, I mean, that was up nearly 10%. And if you switch over to look at the yield on the benchmark 10-year U.S. Treasury bond, it tells a similar story. Yields rose over 122 basis points off of the July lows, to the point where the 30-year bond rally was brought into question, which I think speaks to the strength of this narrative.
Yeah, you know, it does, Aaron, but you know, as I look at this, I find it a very easy narrative. I don't find there to be any nuance in it. It's something that the market has constructed to justify higher prices, and it really does take as given, or it has taken as given, all the positive things: tax breaks, infrastructure spending, et cetera, et cetera. And it's really kind of ignored any potential problems that Trump may have getting stuff through Congress, getting through the House, which obviously are both solidly Republican. And I think that narrative has been flawed from day one. I think markets were looking for a reversal. They were looking for this reason to just blow off a little bit more steam, and they've had it. And I think reality is just about starting to kick in.
But Grant, when you do a roll call of economic indicators around the world, it kind of makes sense that this reflation narrative emerged. I mean, just look at the U.S. PMI index. It ripped higher to 57.5. You look at China PMI. I mean, that's rebounded since fourth quarter of 2015. Well, on fiscal injections, particularly to the state-owned enterprises. But, you know, just looking at the Caixin China General Manufacturing PMI, that is in expansionary territory. Now, you move on to Europe. It may be lagging, but composite PMI there is approaching pre-sovereign debt crisis highs established in 2010 and 2011. Now, finally, moving on, just looking at it broadly for CPI across US, EU, and China, you know, the US and EU are picking up substantially, and China's turning lower, but on the aggregate, it does look like
global reflation is back on?
Well, look, it does until you get into the weeds a little bit and you start looking at base effects. I think this is the important thing people need to understand. And let's not forget, we have to understand the year-on-year change from where oil was last year, oil being the biggest component of the CPI. You know, Raoul's spoken about this in his Real Vision presentation recently. It's very important that oil peaked about this time last year. So we are going to see that start to fall off, and that is going to really make it a struggle for inflation to continue to march higher from here.
And so if we return back to the narrative, what is a narrative? Well, it's essentially an account of connected events. It's a story that people or even markets tell themselves in order to make sense of the world around them. And at the heart of the reflation narrative lie Trump's potential policies, or as they call it, Trumponomics.
Yeah, look, as with any story, you have to break this down into its various component parts. And my co-founder of Real Vision, Raoul Paul, the author of The Global Macro Investor, did just that to explain the main drivers of this narrative recently.
And so the main elements of the Trump reflation story are tax cuts, which have yet to be passed and have yet to be approved. But that's one element. So people think that tax cuts generally are stimulative to the economy. Now, it's not yet clear whether the tax cuts that Trump have are actually tax cuts overall, or whether he has to rob one side to pay for the other. The other part is the infrastructure spend. Infrastructure spending is accretive to GDP growth, because if the government spends money and builds roads and bridges and internet infrastructure and all the other things, that employs people and that has a supposed money multiplier. The third main part of the Trump reflation policy that's out there and the market have been holding on to is kind of the, let's call it, Made in America policy. That is the trade isolationist idea where American companies produce American goods in America. Now, the idea behind that simplistically is, if American companies are making cars or other manufacturing goods in the US, then obviously they have to invest in the US to build factories, and they need to employ American workers, which means American wages go up, and that is good for the economy because people can spend more and it creates jobs at home as opposed to sending money abroad. But what it does mean for companies is their costs go up. Do they pass those costs on to people, which is the inflation part of the reflation trade? It would be inflationary, essentially, to do this because it drives up wages at home and the costs for American companies because, let's face it, it's cheaper to produce T-shirts in Ethiopia than it is in the US. Regardless of what my view on this is, it's all down to whether these things can generate the animal spirits that drive the US economy. Those are the things where it means that people want to invest more money, they want to take risk, they want to not save money or buy back their shares, they want to invest in infrastructure, they want to invest in new factories. Now, we haven't seen that animal spirits for the last 20 years. They've been dwindling over time as fixed asset investment has been falling and falling and falling, and companies have instead bought back their shares. So, you know, there's a lot to play for here.
And so, Grant, when I listen to what Raoul is saying here, you know, I've never read a good story that didn't have a little bit of suspense or mystery about what the outcomes were. And you can, I think you can apply this to markets, right? Because financial markets, they don't price in actualities, but they price in anticipation. And that's essentially what we're dealing with here.
Yeah, it is. But I think the important thing to understand here, and what's, I think, changed since 2008, or rather since 2009, is that the market is looking for any positive angle. You're right. It used to discount things, but it used to be far more concerned with the potential pitfalls. Right now, this central bank put has caused markets to really look for the positive narrative, assuming that the negative narrative will be taken care of by central banks. And it's really dangerous. You know, this is the absolute crux of moral hazard. And we're seeing that right now in America with the response to the potential Trumpflation trade.
So what's happened now is the bone-crushing misery of American politics that takes so long to get things passed, so much bickering, that all of the promise and hope and dreams now comes down to the reality of the political system, and that takes time. And again, dreams end up getting trimmed and trimmed and trimmed down to something that's barely passable. So that's the game we now have to play. We've gone from the hope trade, and now it's the reality trade, and then we'll get to the outcome trade.
Well, bone-crushing sounds pretty apt, Grant, but I can think of a couple more ways to describe the U.S. political system. You know, one of them being opaque. I can think of wasteful. And my new favorite, swampy.
Yeah, it's interesting because what we've seen, the hope side of this is that, okay, Trump's got the White House. The Republicans have the House and the Senate. This is going to be a nice, easy cakewalk for him. We're not going to have any of the divisive fighting that we saw between the Obama Democrats and the who-knows-who Republicans for the last 8 years. You know, there was a real division there. And the polarization just got broader and broader as we went through those 8 years. Instead, what we're seeing is that there are now divides within the Republican Party. And so what people thought was going to be nice and straightforward is now running up against the deficit hawks. It's running up against those looking to put a pin in the repeal and replace for Obamacare. So we're back to the fighting, except this time it's infighting. And, you know, there's nobody that we've spoken to on Real Vision that understands this part of American politics better than Dr. Harold Malmgren.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Malmgren is just a wealth of experience, having been the senior advisor to four U.S. presidents, including Presidents Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Ford.
A new president comes in power, or comes into the office, let's call it that. And the first thing that's going to happen is he's going to say, well, here's my agenda. Here's my State of the Union. I want these things done. And traditionally, there would be a honeymoon period. But with this, after this election, there won't be any honeymoon. There will be, you know, the battle's already begun between Trump and Ryan. And Trump doesn't understand that you can't function without the Speaker's help. So if you make an enemy of him, he'll just sit and wait for you. And the first thing you want, he'll just cut it off. And then, you know, he'll keep doing that until you say, come up submissively and say, I'm sorry, I was wrong. It's just the way it works, because the president doesn't control a vast number of votes. It's the machinery in Congress that does that job. So there'll be an impasse. But within Congress, usually in the early period of a president, the two parties will informally agree some things should be done. But these parties are now not only in serious conflict with one another, but internally they're divided.
Yeah.
So we're going to have a period of chaos and gridlock. I mean, that's what we call it, but it's not just gridlock. So I think the early months, you're going to get a lot of talk and a lot of maneuvering for power. Who's you know, chief of the barnyard? Which animal has the rights over all others? That's going to be a pretty serious quarrel, and the president can't control that. It's not in his hands. Now he can start writing executive orders, and then all of that goes to the Supreme Court or appellate courts. But the courts, as they stand now, they're going to overturn a lot of that stuff. This Consumer Financial Protection Bureau just got beaten down by the appellate court. And the courts will begin to play a role. What I'm projecting is a very slow motion response to the economy's troubles.
Yeah, this is extraordinary. Now, anybody listening to this that didn't actually see that interview in full would struggle to believe me if I told them that Dr. Malmgren was actually talking there back in October of 2016. I mean, it's extraordinary. Here's a man that understands that world intimately and has had a tremendous amount of experience there. And what he said was going to happen is exactly what happened, you know, down to the travel bans that were getting overturned by the judges, the arguments, the leaking, the fights between Trump and Ryan. I mean, it's truly extraordinary what he said several months before this has all happened.
So for a long period of rethinking, a Congress that is not going to work well for a while, much less well in the past, no honeymoon, and the president will find, whoever it is, that it takes 6 to 9 months to assemble the 4,000 political appointees needed, because you not only have to have them all vetted, if they have any money, they have to divest all that. And then you've got security clearances, which is a monumental task, and is handled sloppily sometimes, and then you get bitten back by it. It's a mechanical process. It's like, you know, supply chains. It's how long to get from here to the assembly of that automobile. And we got all these parts that I got to bring together. I always think of it like supply chains management. And then when you start taking initiatives, every new president has some initiative he wants to try out, and then they fall flat. It's the second year of a president in a well-organized Congress that where the action starts. That's a long time. But the key thing to remember for everybody is it won't happen in a day or a week or a month. It's going to be a process that will be painfully slow until the recession becomes too painful to bear, and then there will be action. And then finally, and then there will be a meeting of ideologies into, you know, a conversion into, well, you know, how do I survive this? But the markets are looking for a moment, an inflection point, something, you know, that everything will change on January. No.
You know, Grant, going back to this interview, I remember when I was watching it and just observing Dr. Malmgren's facial expressions and also his body language. I mean, you can feel the impasse. You can feel the sluggishness and just the friction of that political system. And it was just manifesting itself in how he was talking about it. I thought that was really interesting.
It is. It's fascinating. You know, when you do get the chance to listen to someone who's been so deep in something like this as Dr. Malmgren has, you really understand that the actors change and the names and the faces change, but the system, you know, this swamp that Donald Trump has promised to drain, it's just overwhelmingly powerful, and it's so ingrained, the behaviors are so ingrained, that really the changing of the actors just doesn't really change the play. And the markets, I suspect, are going to wake up to this. And again, we come back to that thing we were talking about earlier, Aaron, this moral hazard, this believing that the downside is all taken care of, so let's just focus on the positives. I think markets are in for a nasty shock.
And so I think it's probably useful to summarize where we are right now. You know, we're talking about the Trumponomics, we're talking about the reflation, and this consists of three things: tax reform, infrastructure spending, and isolationist trade policies. Now, as Rob was saying, there are no details, there's no congressional will, and there's no collaboration. And just from hearing from Dr. Malmgren, I mean, we're basically facing the worst inter- and intra-party gridlock that we've seen in decades.
Yeah, this is something that happens all the time. The markets, they look back in history for some kind of parallel, some kind of narrative, and the one that we seem to have alighted on very quickly after the election result was that of Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. And going back to my friend David Hay of Evergreen GavCal, he saw the same things that I did.
So let's just go back and think about what the early years of Reagan brought. Those first 2 years of his term, basically you had a severe recession, one of the worst, actually it was the worst up to that time since the Great Depression. You had a nasty bear market, and he got shot. You know, it was kind of a tough first couple of years in office. And I actually think that all those things could happen again, and you know, hopefully nobody takes a shot at Trump, but let's face it, he's a very polarizing figure. A lot of people don't like him. I hope he's got great security. But the point is that there could be some real negative surprises coming in the months ahead. If it is Reaganomics 2.0, but also consider what Reagan inherited. Very high inflation, for sure, which in consumer prices, not asset prices. So what Trump has got is very subdued consumer price inflation, but very high asset price inflation. And as he has said repeatedly, it's a big, fat, ugly bubble out there. And as soon as interest rates go up, there's going to be trouble. Well, guess what? Interest rates are going up. And I think that's another thing that could be a bit of an echo of Reagan, because what happened in Reagan's first year in office, 1981, was that Volcker, trying to beat consumer inflation, raised interest rates repeatedly and to a level that, you know, broke the back of inflation, which was great. You know, that worked for years and years thereafter, but those first couple of years were brutal. And these first couple of years could be brutal because we do have this asset inflation that has been caused by interest rates being far too low.
Yeah, you know, David's absolutely right. When you look at where Reagan started, you know, some of the metrics that Ronald Reagan inherited, he inherited a CPI that was just shy of 15%. He inherited a 10-year that was yielding just shy of 11%. And the S&P was trading on about 7x earnings. The federal debt in the U.S. was less than a trillion. It was about $800 billion. And the debt to GDP was, I think, 30, 31%. Now, you contrast that with Trump. He's got a CPI of 1.6, a 10-year yielding less than 2%, The S&P, when he took over, was at 21 times earnings. And he had a federal debt closing in on $20 trillion. And a debt to GDP that's tripled to over 100%. This is not a point at which a kind of Reagan rally is going to start. And it's worth pointing out that in the first 18 months of Reagan's term, the S&P lost about 27%. So, this Trump-Reagan parallel, I just don't get it. I really don't.
Well, and Grant, I think another important point here is that this is the financialization of the economy. You know, now the market is the economy. And so with a rising interest rate environment, that actually increases the probability of a recession coming on. And when you look at the business cycle, Trump could actually be tested way sooner than later.
I think we just have to be realistic that this is likely to be a sluggish growth environment still, with maybe a bit of an improvement. But the other part of it is that he can't repeal the economic cycle. We're very, very late in that. And we're seeing all kinds of evidence of things that, whether it's rents starting to fall in a number of major cities, including incredibly around here in the Seattle area, where the economy has been so strong. We're seeing the auto market look very long in the tooth. Yes, sales are certainly very strong, but it's with huge incentives and very, very funky financing. I think that the subprime auto lending could be the equivalent of what the subprime mortgage debacle was 10 years ago. So there's a plethora of indications that we're very late in this game. And that was different with Reagan. Reagan came in after a recession when Carter was president. He got another recession because we talked about with Volcker cranking rates up. But as soon as those interest rates started coming down, I mean, you had a tremendous coiled spring effect. And he also had a market when he came in that was trading at 9x earnings, single-digit PE. Instead, you've got Trump in there with what we think is the most expensive market of all time.
Well, you know, listening to David, listening to Raoul, and I've alluded to it a couple of times also in what I've said in between them, there is an 800-pound gorilla in this room, and that is the Federal Reserve. And not just the Fed, but all the central banks around the world.
We've come to this part of the story where our brave narrative encounters the quintessential boss fight along the quest. And it's important to bring up the Fed because they do have an outsized influence on what happens to Trump during his first term.
You know, Yellen has got to believe that she's a lame duck Fed chairman. She's got a year. And I don't think she's got any great love for Donald Trump. So I wouldn't be surprised if she, raises rates more than expected, creates some turmoil. But I do believe the Fed feels like they need to have rates high enough that during the next crisis they can cut them and have an impact. And so if there's kind of this resurgence of animal spirits because of Trumpphoria, and she's got a window that she can jack rates up to what was kind of a quasi-normal level, and I would postulate that's around 2. I don't think we're getting back to 4, no way 5% on the Fed funds rate. I think 2 is probably the new 4. And people ask, well, why would you buy any bonds if you think the Fed's going to be raising rates? And if you look historically, particularly in the last major Fed tightening cycle, the damage to the bond market was done before the Fed ever raised. And typically, it's the first few hikes that where you really see bonds get hit. And then as they tighten and tighten and tighten, bonds actually start to rally and bring their yields down. And that's how you get the flat and inverted yield curve. And I actually didn't think we would get that this time, but I think we might. I think we could see a very flat inverted yield curve around 2%.
Which is exactly what we're getting now as we speak, this flattening of the yield curve and on its way to being inverted. Now, maybe it makes sense to stop right here to explain to people who are unfamiliar what a flattening yield curve or an inverted yield curve means or signifies. This is a situation or a scenario where near-term rates are greater than or equal to long-term rates. And this is typically viewed as a harbinger of an economic downturn and could hasten recession. And a way to illustrate this is actually to think of it from a bank's perspective. A bank typically borrows at short-term. A bank borrows at short-term rates and lends at long-term rates. But when you have a flat or inverted yield curve, a bank would be borrowing at higher short-term rates and lending at lower long-term rates, which just doesn't make sense, right? Because ultimately, that something like that is negative for credit growth in an economic system that is unfortunately sustained on credit expansion.
Yeah, and it's interesting that we're already seeing that come through in the data. I mean, if you look at the lending data, it started to fall precipitously. And I've read several bits of very smart commentary on this in the past few days alone. So, David saw this happening. I think he's absolutely right about the Fed being desperate to have some room to cut. And I think if you told Janet Yellen she could get to 2%, without upsetting the apple cart, she would bite your arm off. I personally don't think they'll get to 2%. I think if the markets think that's where they're headed, then they will jump ahead of that and probably bring the Fed back to easing faster than people think.
And so this tightening of financial conditions actually ties into a major unintended consequence of two of Trump's potential policies, and that's the U.S. dollar and the kind of havoc a strengthening dollar could inflict upon the policies Trump is hoping to implement.
Yeah, there's been a lot of focus on the tax reform, and also there's $2 trillion in repatriated corporate profits sitting overseas, which if it does come home, and I do have some doubts that it would all come back to the United States, but let's posit that it does, that would mean far fewer dollars, physical dollars in the system. And perhaps most crucially, the U.S. renegotiating trade agreements and this kind of move towards isolationism and economic nationalism, initially by Trump, but one would have to think, should he go through with it, then by other parts of the world. That has a very pernicious side effect for the rest of the world, as Raoul explained.
If America runs no trade deficit, because they've basically shut their borders to trade or have offset it via taxes, then it means the rest of the world, who used to buy goods and sell goods to America, particularly sell goods to America, they used to receive dollars. Now, suddenly they're not getting dollars because America generally is not buying goods from them because it's buying goods from home. Now, that's all well and good in a balanced system, but the fact is that the rest of the world is short $10 trillion. So they need dollars to service those debts and also for the functioning of their economy. So if you take those dollars away, then it becomes a mad scramble for dollars. If America doesn't do anything about it, because as a reserve currency, you need to run a deficit because other people need your currency. If you don't do that, you will eventually, and the word is eventually in inverted commas, lose your reserve currency status because everybody else is forced to use something else. Now, that was one of the reasons behind the Plaza Accord, where the dollar was just getting too strong. So they knew it was becoming impossible for people to find enough dollars. I think that outcome is potentially out there again, but it will develop over the next 2 or 3 years. I know the dollar's correcting somewhat now. I still think it goes much higher because I don't see anything that the US is doing that is going to weaken the dollar.
So, Grant, maybe this was before the time of some of our listeners. Can you explain what the Plaza Accord is?
Yeah, look, in very simple terms, the last time we saw, or back in the 80s, sorry, the time before last, we saw a really strong dollar bull market like this. Eventually, it became too much for the central bankers of the world to bear. They all got together at the Plaza Hotel, which I think at that point in time was actually owned by one Donald J. Trump. And they agreed to basically put a cap on the dollar. And this was a concerted central bank effort to weaken the dollar. And it worked. If you look at the chart, you'll see the tremendous run-up and then the total collapse of the dollar once all the central banks got behind it. And this is something, you know, Raoul and I go backwards and forwards about, and he's been absolutely spot on with this strong dollar thesis for the last 18 months, 2 years. And I've been with him all the way. And I find myself diverging with him at the moment because I think, to his point here, I think Plaza Accord 2.0 will happen. But I think it will necessarily have to happen far sooner in that rally than it did last time. So, you know, I'm not as convinced that the dollar runs as strongly as Raoul does. But I absolutely respect not just his opinion, but a lot of the other super smart guys that do believe there's another major leg up in this bull market. I just think that the side effects this time would be even more dangerous than we saw in the 80s. And so any Plaza Accord 2.0 would happen far, far sooner in the narrative than it did back in the 1980s.
Yeah, Grant, I tend to agree with you on that, because if you look at the trade-weighted dollar chart and, you know, take it back to 1971 at the end of the Bretton Woods system, it appears that ever smaller dollar rallies are sufficient to induce some kind of global shock. And I think this is the grand irony of it all, is that despite the best of intentions, you know, putting into place potential tax and isolationist policies would actually create a global shock that threatens to drag the U.S. down with it, all the while rates are just still too close to zero to provide any cushion in that sort of event.
I think it's misplaced optimism. He'll get through some things, and some things he won't get through, and we have no idea of the course of the economy over it. As I said, I think that he can pass pretty much anything in a recession, but without a recession he won't get through most things. You know, we saw how TARP managed to get through. I mean, crazy bullshit gets through in a recession. So I think if he wants to get this done, if he's politically motivated and he wants to get this done, a recession is a good thing.
Yeah, this is interesting to me. Because I think Rael's absolutely right. My fear is that to call on a recession now for political purposes, thinking, you know, this, if we want to get things done, let's just let a recession happen. I don't think this is going to be any common or garden recession. And I think this is a genie you do not want to let out of the bottle, because it could get out of control in a hurry. And you don't have the ammunition to fight it that you've had in previous recessions. You know, with interest rates at 1%, if you do get a recession, which I suspect will be a doozy, you just have no bullets. So I just think that would be not just dangerous, but utterly reckless to do that. That's not to say it won't happen, though.
All right, so coming up next is our Things I Got Wrong segment, where we speak with a market expert about an investing hiccup or mistake they made, and we ask them to share lessons that they learned so that our listeners can benefit from that experience and apply it to their own investing.
Yeah, this week I'm just thrilled to have David Hay on the program. David's a dear friend of mine, and I've looked up to David for a long, long time. He's a tremendous investor and an even better man, and I can't say anything better about anyone than that. And I think you'll really enjoy listening to David talk about one of the mistakes he's made.
So I'm joined this week by David Hay, who is the Principal and Chief Investment Officer of Evergreen GovCal, as well as the author of the must-read Evergreen Virtual Advisor Market Commentary blog. David, thanks for taking the time.
Oh, you're welcome, Aaron. Thanks for inviting me to be part of this.
Great. So to kick things off, as we usually do in this segment, can you talk about a time in your investing career where you made a mistake or faced an investing challenge?
Well, as you and I talked about before this interview, that will be a very long list since I've been doing this for almost 40 years. But, you know, I tend to think, like most human beings, about mistakes made more recently. Those are always the most vivid in my memory bank. And as you and I have discussed in the past, the very recent past, the underestimation of what the central banks have been able to do with their, you know, basically unlimited printing presses was a mistake. You know, we did think that there would be kind of a look through at the lack of sustainability of that kind of a bull market catalyst. And that was certainly a mistake. There really has been no fears, at least in a very long time, about exit strategy. You know, what happens when that stops or reverses? And, you know, I think somebody could say, well, look, the Fed stopped QE, you know, a couple of years ago and the markets kept going. But what that ignores, of course, is that the ECB and the Bank of Japan and the Swiss National Bank, there's been a lot of QEs ramping up in recent years, and that money tends to go to America in many cases, into U.S. stocks and U.S. bonds. And the other thing I think that I underestimated is corporations willing to buy back $500 billion a year or more of their increasingly overpriced stocks and leveraging up to do it. And again, you would think the corporations would have learned their lesson because they did that in spades back in 06, 07, and that ended horribly. So, you know, again, just underestimating either whether it's the gullibility of investors or the power of central banks to force them to do things that in their heart of hearts they know really are ill-advised.
You know, David, I don't know if I'd give them that much credit insofar as realizing that all this money changing is ill-advised, but, you know, the $4 trillion question is, where do we currently stand with central bank confidence?
Well, it's a great question because, you know, the old saying is don't fight the Fed, and you could say that events of recent years have validated that. But on the other hand, if you look back to 2000, 2002, 2007, 2000, early 2009, the Fed was cutting interest rates like crazy, and yet the market was getting absolutely annihilated. So it's, you know, the don't fight the Fed works sometimes, doesn't work other times. And, you know, maybe the best way to do it is to look at what investor risk appetites are like and try to sync the two. In other words, when investors are in an acute risk off mode, there's the Fed's not going to really be able to staunch that with aggressive cutting. I don't know about that, but one of the other mistakes that I've made here lately, until very lately, is not paying enough attention to extreme sentiment readings. So, in other words, if you were to go back to the summer of 2015, the market had been quite complacent and very bullish. And then all of a sudden, the renminbi fell sharply and oil prices continued to crash. And, you know, people went from, investors in general went from extremely optimistic to very bearish. And the market did pull back about 15% and sentiment readings got super, super bearish. And so I think a mistake that investors like us, who tend to be very long-term focused, make is you ignore those kinds of opportunities to, in this case, say, cover some of your shorts or hedges. And that's, you know, that's a really a good lesson learned, is that, you know, you really do need to, whatever your long-term viewpoint is or positioning is, you should probably adjust that to when you get these, not minor swings, but, you know, just really off the chart readings, either of bullishness or bearishness. So, and I think another, I know a lot of your folks that read your letters or subscribe to your service are very bullish gold long-term, and we are too. But there have been times here recently, like last summer, where just it seemed like everybody was bullish, and of course prices had moved extremely rapidly, and it was a good time to be, you know, taking profits in gold. And so really, we guess what I'm saying is that I think an investor who, and maybe there's not that many of us left that think long-term, maybe we're like dodo birds, but there are some out there that have this, you know, I'm just going to hold gold till fiat currencies become totally discredited. But, you know, if that's could be a very long wait, and you miss tremendous opportunities to take profits and then buy back during weakness. And so I think, you know, if you're, I guess the best advice I'd give to a long-term investor is, you know, have a core position, but be willing to trade around that, you know, under those parameters. And we've been doing that more and more, but certainly in the past, I feel like that's been one of my bigger mistakes.
Yeah, you know, your point about reconciling a long-term view, you know, be it on the demise of fiat currency with a, you know, let's call it a short-term nimbleness and sensitivity to sentiment readings, it rings true in principle, but how does that apply on a practical basis, and especially in current market conditions?
Well, I think a good example is small caps. So we have been for years extremely bearish on small cap, and realistically, small caps have been underperforming for the most part, but they've had some ferocious rallies. So summer of, actually it was early 2016, small caps were down 27% from peak to trough. They still looked very expensive on a valuation basis, but that's a pretty big decline. And you also had, once again, it seemed like the entire world was bearish on small caps, which should have meant that we were closing out, and we did close out some of our hedges, but we really should have closed out almost all of them when you see that, and then be in a position where you can come back in much harder during the inevitable rally. So that's, I just think we're doing that more and more at Evergreen, and I think that's probably a better way than just, you know, waiting for the epic collapse, you know, a 60-70% derating of small caps, which I think ultimately is coming. Those are the kind of things that I think as a more opportunistic investor are like your golden chance to make money with not much risk. And it's, you know, small caps have not exactly been crushed because we've had a very ebullient market, but they certainly have underperformed since early December. You know, they had that big run after the election, and since then they've been correcting to going sideways. So I think that's, you know, a tactic that we're using at our firm more and more. And I just think when you've got the investment community, particularly the speculative investment community, who doesn't have a very good track record, when they're absolutely convinced something's going to happen, either bullish or bearish, you almost always want to be on the other side of that, at least near term.
Yeah, holding that long-term view, but also trading tactically sounds like an elusive sweet spot, I guess. And hopefully our listeners can build up the self-awareness to get to that point. Well, unfortunately, Dave, this is all the time we have. But before we sign off, can you tell our listeners where they can find your work or get in touch with you?
You can follow us at our website, which is evergreengovcal.com, or maybe the easiest thing to do is just to, if they want to get our weekly letter, which is free, Evergreen Virtual Advisor, they could just email me at dhay, D-H-A-Y, my short last name, dhay at evergreencapital or GavCal, either way. And by the way, GavCal is spelled G-A-V-E-K-A-L.net.
Well, that's all the time we have for today, but David, thank you for your time.
You're welcome, Aaron.
You know, Grant, David, it was such a pleasure to speak with. And, you know, I feel like there's a recurring theme here. Well, first of all, underestimating the Fed firepower and investor credulity. I think not only David, but I think a couple of weeks back, we had Bill Fleckenstein come on and say something similar. Now, just hearing that, is it possible that we just might be at peak Fed firepower or peak Fed confidence?
I'm astounded. I too underestimated how long this would go on for. There are plenty of little signs that maybe that confidence is starting to wane around the edges. And, you know, I kind of want to get there just because I think we need to get that out of the way. It may be that we're not there yet, but, you know, what's that old that quote? It may not be the end of the world, but you can see it from here. And I think that goes for the end of central bank credibility. So I'm paying careful attention to that because I think we're getting close. And I think when we get there, it's going to be a very, very important turning point.
And Grant, another interesting comment or lesson that David talked about was sort of paying attention to extreme sentiment readings. Now, I just personally, I have more of a long-term bias or long-term orientation when I look at, when I think about investing or look at trades, but, you know, factoring that extreme sentiment reading, I mean, I think last week we were talking about the extreme sentiment or the extreme positioning in oil futures. Now, how do you work in that nearer term sentiment reading with a longer term? I mean, how do you see those two things combining together to form like a larger understanding or a larger thesis?
Well, look, sentiment readings are strange things. I'm always very, very wary of them. To me, they tend to mark great turning points. Every time sentiment's high, to me, that's the time to be on red alert. And when people are just black bearish, it's a time when you need to be looking for an uptick. So I use them as contraindicators rather than anything else. But I think you do have to pay attention when they get to extremes. It really is a warning that things are about to change. And so I pay great attention to when these things get to extreme readings. All right. Well, that concludes another episode 9, Aaron. We're in double figures if we make it to next week.
Nearly.
Yeah, nearly. Now, just a quick legal plug before we end. Anything you heard on this episode really should not be considered as trading advice. These are our opinions and the opinions of our contributors. Everybody listening, you really need to do your own fundamental research, chart your technicals if that's what you like to do, place your stops and trade responsibly.
Absolutely right, Grant. Well, coming up next week, we have our commentary segment where we feature Carson Block, the famed short seller and founder of Muddy Waters Research. Now, short selling is a personal favorite topic of mine, but it's also incredibly hard to master, or so I've been told. So given these frothy markets, I thought no better time to hear from someone like Carson.
Yeah, you're going to love this. Carson has some just astounding stories about researching and shorting fraudulent Chinese companies. So do tune in next week and listen to that.
If you've got an interesting question about this week's show, we'd love to hear it. Send us an email or voice note at podcast@realvision.com.
And if you enjoyed what you heard this week, then please do subscribe on iTunes. And if you can find a couple of minutes to review us, that really would help us move up the charts.
Yep, the reviews really help. And to keep up to date with the latest interviews, research publications, and podcast episodes, be sure to follow us on Twitter at @realvision.
And you will also find us on Facebook and LinkedIn if you just search for Real Vision. You can follow me on Twitter at @TTMYGH.
And you can follow me at @MacroDidact. And that's it from us.
We will see you here same time next week.